The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org. This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com.
Thanks for joining us on this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. I'm Andrew Keats, assistant editor at Voice of San Diego. And last week, I interviewed Josh Stevens. He's the author of a new book called The Urban Mystique. It was part of an event put on by the San Diego Tijuana Urban Land Institute. Josh lives in Los Angeles, where he is a land use and development journalist. The book is all about the potential of cities like Los Angeles and San Diego, what they are and what they could be. We had a really interesting conversation on the last 10 years of land use and development trends here in California, a time period where both of us were covering the same things, where we talked about the way cities recovered from the last Great Recession, all the way till they developed right before the pandemic with things like the rise of the YIMBY movement. Here is my chat with Josh Stevens.
So I figure I'll just throw it to you in an open way, Josh. You grew up in the Los Angeles covered in Bill Fulton, your boss and friend's book, The Reluctant Metropolis. And that book covered the sort of anti-development wars of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And that you grew up in that Los Angeles, and now you live and cover a different Los Angeles, a Los Angeles that's more comfortable itself as a international city. And so I want to just kind of give it to you open-ended. What does that mean? How has Los Angeles and how have cities in California changed since the time that Bill covered in Reluctant Metropolis?
I'll describe LA, or at least my perception of LA, and I think that there are probably elements of it that apply to San Diego and that apply elsewhere in California. But the way I describe my upbringing in West LA in the 80s, early 90s, LA, especially at that time, you know, I was aware of the suburbs and what that sort of idyllic life was like, whether it was real or sort of fabricated, of, you know, kids playing in the street and walking to school and having barbecues and being very, very family oriented. And I think that's one urban ideal. There's some skepticism about that ideal, and mostly from Betty Friedan, who was the inspiration for the title of this book, The Urban Mystique, obviously a riff off the feminine mystique. And I was very glad that nobody had written Urban Mystique before, because it's very hard these days to come up with a title with the word city or urban in it, because there have been so many books, many of them great, written about cities over the past years. I think I was aware of that suburban mindset, which I think is obviously very, you know, prevalent in San Diego County. But I was also aware of the urban mindset. I was aware of Manhattan. I was aware of the Chicago Loop. I was aware of London, both in travels and also I was big into reading. So I read tons and watched a lot of movies and very much perceived that those cities were very, very different from my city. West LA was really in between. Mid-density townhouses and low-rise apartments. It had access to urban, what we would call amenities, the museums and the theaters and the downtown and so forth, although downtown LA at the time was nothing special. But it didn't have the sense of neighborhood. It didn't have the sense of security. It didn't have the sense of togetherness that the suburbs did. And in some ways, I feel like it was the worst of both worlds. you know, kids in Manhattan grew up very sophisticated. Kids in the suburbs grew up very secure and had a lot of fun. And kids in West LA were kind of, I don't know, it was a bit of a trap. And so I was very aware of that. And sort of as I, you know, majored in English in college and then turned my eye towards what I was really interested in, I realized I was really interested in learning and analyzing cities the way that I had learned about and analyzed literature, you know, in the early part of my education. So I'm very interested in planning, obviously. I'm interested in the minutiae of planning and the policies and so forth. But I'm also interested in the culture of cities. I'm interested in how people interact in cities. I'm interested in the shared values or lack thereof in cities generally, and in particular cities. And I think it's interesting to talk about the values between, say, an LA and a San Diego and, you know, a San Francisco, for instance. I think it's interesting to think about how the built environment and how the planning schemes match up with these sort of human cultural aspects and demographics, you know, which we can discuss at length. So that's sort of the impetus for my career, and it's the impetus for a lot of the pieces in the book. I wrote it for two audiences. One is for the non-planning audience. I'm sure we all have friends, you know, whatever form of land use we're in, who are curious about land use, but don't know anything about it. Because it's a very important, it's, you know, it literally surrounds us, but it's an opaque topic. And I like to write, and especially when I'm having the most fun, I like to write pieces for my non-practitioner friends. But I also wrote it for planners. I also wrote it for professionals, not because I'm going to teach them anything specific that they don't already know from their technical skills, their professional skills, but to hopefully remind them of aspects of cities that don't cross their desk on a daily basis. The average planner probably does not think about the culture of Los Angeles on a daily basis. That planner is thinking about the population trends and the regulations and how wide the streets are and what's R1 versus R3 versus R75. So I want to remind the planners of sort of, you know, the magic of cities, for lack of a better description, but I also want to inform lay people about some of the, you know, some of the technical aspects, but also just sort of the way planners think and the way that I think. So that sets the table. I guess, lastly, the question is, how is LA different? I think the tension that I discussed, that I experienced growing up, that Bill Fulton wrote about in The Reluctant Metropolis, of LA trying to be a big city, but maybe think of itself as a small city, but pretending it's not a city at all. I think that continues. It's a bigger city. It's a more vibrant city. There are many better things about it. You know, to offer one obvious example, we now have tons of public transportation, as do you in San Diego. That was not a glimmer in anyone's eye when I was growing up. The city has grown up, but then there are still people who don't know it exists, who ignore it, who don't understand the benefits, who don't want the benefits of public transportation. That's one example.
I'm interested in what you think, you know, the period specifically covered by your book, the 2010 to roughly 2018 or so. And it's a good time period, or it's an interesting time period, I should say, because I think it basically takes us from the very beginning of the recovery out of the Great Recession towards like right up until, you know, I think you, if you extended it a couple of years, you could say right up until the pandemic. And a lot did seemingly change in urban policy and urban politics during that time period in Southern California. One observation I have, and I'm really curious whether you even agree with this. Did you feel in 2010, like when you were writing about urban policy, land use, development, that you were sort of off to the side, like it was sort of outside of the major attention of what was happening in California, you know, say in Sacramento or what was happening in City Hall, and that by the end of it, that was no longer true, that it had raised in its profile and become sort of the primary focus of California politics?
Andy, 100%. I think it's a great question. Nobody's asked me that question in quite that way. And I think it's a really, really good one. In 2010, when I joined CPDR, first of all, I did not know I'd be there 10 years, but I'm really glad I have, because that's how long it takes to even claim a modicum of expertise in some of these topics. Partly because of how I grew up. I remember learning about, say, new urbanism and smart growth very early on. I think I first learned about them in like 1998 or so in some sort of grad class. And I was like, New urbanism, this sounds amazing. This is what I've been wanting. Smart growth, whatever you want to call it. And I was like, great. Like, I want to see this happen. And lo and behold, I got into the field of planning journalism and realized like, oh, it's a great idea, but it's not really happening. The mainstream in the 2000s was still like a lot of sprawl, right? And there was some infill. Some of the big developers were forming infill units and so forth. But then, boom, 2007 happened. And I would say that was super disappointing for me personally, because in LA, I think a lot of those infill ideas were really gaining momentum. One of my articles is about a grocery store in downtown LA that opened in like 2007, I believe. That store had been in the books for like 7 years at that point. And I was really excited about it because I was like, grocery stores, it's one of the pillars of community. And it was a real symbol of downtown finally coming into its own. The store opened, which was great, but then development just shut down. So I think a lot of the great infill stuff that could have happened from, say, 2007 to 2012 was either delayed or just was wiped away entirely. There are still projects that I remember being talked about in downtown LA that probably would have penciled out nicely, you know, as of 2006, but that didn't happen. The Grand Avenue project, a big Frank Gehry project near the Music Center, that was meant to break ground sometime in the mid-2000s. It topped out like a month ago, literally 15 years later. That's what's going on. So as of 2010, I think that, you know, I was still very hopeful about what development could look like in California, but it was very clear that whatever timeline we had envisioned was wiped off. And, you know, the death of redevelopment, that was one of the, I'd say that was the mega story when I was first at CPDR, was all the machinations and lawsuits and so forth, and Jerry Brown and the budget crisis that got rid of redevelopment, much to the state's detriment. What wasn't present immediately was the sense of the housing crisis. Housing prices weren't great, but they were still modest. The idea of a shortage, I think, you know, we knew we needed housing, but we had built a lot in the 2000s. And, you know, I think the proverbial idea of people living in their parents' basements during the recession and then emerging, you know, in 2011, 2012, I think that was, you know, for a lot of people, accurate. And as with everything in planning, there's a lag. So we didn't realize the pressure. And I think politically, what's true in land use is things really have to reach a crisis before something happens politically. So to your point, yeah, I think land use in the early 2010s was, you know, just kind of stagnating. But now it is so much front and center in, you know, every bit of local politics. It's either public safety or it's land use. And a lot of people, you know, understandably, mingle the two in a lot of their discussions. And, you know, I think on the state level, you know, there's still a lot of issues going on, but there is so much more energy and chatter and advocacy and opposition around land use today than there certainly was 10 years ago. It's a little weird as a journalist. Like, I was a little niche journalist back in the day. Very few people were writing or talking about these things. And today, land use issues are all over the place. You know, in many, New York Times yesterday had an article about a design contest in LA that probably would not have, the contest wouldn't have happened 10 years ago, but the article probably would not have happened either. So yeah, we're living in a very different world in terms of the conversation. I'm not sure how different a world it is in terms of actual built environment, other than that everything's more expensive.
It's interesting because I was writing about real estate at a mostly defunct paper called the Daily Transcript back then. I used to read your redevelopment writing at CPDR. And, you know, it's funny, I think back a lot that I used to write stories at the time about the housing market. And I would talk to real estate professors and they used to say, I don't know if they're out there taking a victory lap, but they should be. They used to tell me all the time, the story of the time was short sales and distressed properties and foreclosures. And the concern that they were raising was everybody who's buying a house right now is having their needs met. The supply is being met by foreclosures, by distressed sales. So we're not building new homes. And that is creating the next crisis, and that we're going to have this massive shortage that's being built up right now And 5 years from now, we're just going to be talking about how expensive housing prices were. And, you know, I used to dutifully quote them and say, okay, I'm sure that's true. And then sure enough, 5 years later, it becomes the biggest story in California politics. One of the things that came with that, as that conversation changed, was a new movement. The story used to be the only people who showed up to a hearing on a housing proposal or a policy change were the people who were most likely to directly feel the negative effects of that, or neighbors, or derisively NIMBYs, which you have a lengthy chapter on here. And in this 10-year period, we saw the rise of this counter movement, YIMBYs. And I'm curious what you think, how has the rise of the YIMBY movement changed the policy discussion that we go through every day? And how much has it actually changed the end result of our built environment and what's actually happening?
I find it super interesting. I think that, as you said, I think the housing crisis itself sort of necessitated the rise of the YIMBYs. I think there are a few other factors. I even think of it in like deep historical terms. And if you bear with me, I like to go back often to Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis, in which he basically said, we've been, you know, imperializing and colonizing the continent for many decades now, up till 1890, obviously problematic. We obviously want to acknowledge the native peoples that were, you know, slaughtered and otherwise disrespected in that process. And we are living on their land now. But as a historical sort of analysis, I think Turner's really interesting because he basically said, the continent is now full, right? It's closed at the point at which we have colonized all the way to the Pacific. And, you know, what I read from him is that that created an anxiety of, oh, wow, we don't have more land to like conquer. Now what do we do with ourselves? And I feel like that process repeats itself over and over again ever since 1890, wherein whatever your vision of the frontier is, or whatever your vision of land is, gets more and more full and tighter and tighter. So that here in California, we now have a much larger population than ever. The people who lived here 40 years ago are now sharing it with more people. I think that's a good thing, but some people think it's a bad thing. And point being is that the incumbent anti-development, let's call them the NIMBY movement, for lack of a better word, has gotten sort of more and more anxious. At the same time, we now have this younger generation that has come up and out of economic necessity is now advocating for more housing. And I think the YIMBY movement's interesting because it can mean a lot of different things to different people. It's got a libertarian wing, it's got a humanitarian wing, it's got sort of a just a common sense wing, as people might say. And I think it came about you know, appropriately when people came out of their parents' basements, especially when they came of age post-college and had a more sophisticated understanding of these things and how to live on their own and realize they do have voices. I also want to credit the internet. I think that homeowners have always had a structural advantage in having homeowners associations and addresses and neighbors, and more grassroots people don't necessarily have that kind of proximity. So they need to organize in different means. And I think that, you know, websites and email and social media and so forth facilitated the rise of the YIMBY movement in a sort of demographically appropriate way. And then we had people like Sonia Trauss, who's sort of the forebearer of the California YIMBY movement, who just to her credit was just out there. Like she is outspoken and doesn't care what people think of her and, you know, let her righteous indignation really propel her around the Bay Area. And the movement has really caught on. And at first, I think it was a lot of pep rallies or a lot of just commiseration. But to Andy's question about what is its political, you know, force at this point, and I think it's significant, you know. I write a lot about Sacramento or what comes out of Sacramento, which is a very different kind of reporting than, say, writing about a local development or whatnot. I like to do both, but we are a statewide publication. And if you look at the bills out of Sacramento the past few years, including and especially this year, a lot of those have been sponsored by, co-written by, supported by organized YIMBY groups. California YIMBY, now being the most prominent, that has a very, you know, major presence in San Francisco, aided by, of course, Senator Scott Wiener and Senator Tony Atkins, obviously, who I think are naturally pro-housing legislators. And I think the YIMBY movement has given them an ally, you know, on from the people's side. And they've come up with some, you know, some interesting legislation. Not all of it has passed. Some of it sort of has recurred year after year and been shot down for various reasons, but it comes back. So on the statewide level, I think it's becoming quite effective and it become quite a voice. And the local level is a different matter.
It's interesting because I think NIMBYs feel like they're on the run right now. I feel like NIMBYs no longer feel like they are dictating the terms of the debate. And yet, if you were to take a step back, SB 50 didn't pass. Its predecessor, which was more ambitious than it, didn't pass. And it's in many ways, it's these proposals that themselves make people feel like they're under attack in the first place. And yet they keep failing. And in fact, not even coming all that close to passing in either of those cases. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, those measures have been stripped down to their barest of parts with SB 9 right now. Mm-hmm. And even that, you know, maybe it'll pass. I'm not here to guess what happens with that, but it's not been an easy path, even to the point that it's at right now. And as you know, as we say, that just a few years ago in 2018, when the Wiener's first bill along these lines was proposed, it was much more expansive, much more expansive. And so, is YIMBYism winning?
Certainly, in the timeline of land use, I would say the YIMBY movement has been meteoric. You know, 5 years from basically a bunch of people hanging out at a motel in Boulder, Colorado, all the way to a statewide organization. I think that's, you know, impressive in its own right. Even to get bills sponsored, whether or not they prevail, is impressive. I would also say that, yes, SB 50 failed, its predecessor failed. You know, we'll see what happens this year. At the same time, some things have passed. To me, the most important one are the laws that gave some teeth to the RENA process. You know, the regional needs allocation, which we're all familiar with because they abide, you know, they're organized by the MPOs, so Sandag in your area and Skag in my area. And those have set these housing goals for all of these regions that have then been parceled out to the cities. And that was definitely, you know, those bills to give RENA more teeth, and numbers are eluding me, were definitely supported by the YIMBYs. And I think those passed because they were so wonky. You can look at an SB 50, and if you don't like it, you can imagine, oh my gosh, these horrible developments at this light rail stop, and it's going to demolish my house and so forth. But the law that says that there are penalties if your region does not allocate for a certain number of homes and each jurisdiction doesn't zone for a certain number of homes, that's a harder one for anyone to grasp. So I think those more wonky ones passed. And now we're seeing these RENA allocations are real, and these cities are facing housing elements that are much bigger than otherwise they would have. And that's a win on the YIMBY side. We can debate whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or makes sense or whatever, but I think it's certainly on the YIMBY agenda. And whether an SB 9 or an SB 10 passes, these cities are going to have to figure out how to accommodate those units, whether they like it or not. So they may have to implement their own local versions of those regulations, you know, just to accommodate their RENA numbers. So to me, that's the interesting victory on the YIMBY side.
Yeah, and San Diego, we're sort of center of that battle playing out right now, is the first city to seek state certification of its housing element under those new laws. And California YIMBY is actually sort of, I guess at this point, I'd call it saber rattling around what they may do if the city doesn't make some changes, and sort of pushing the state to come down harder on San Diego's housing element. You alluded in a previous response to maybe there being more success at the state level than at the local level for these sorts of things. What did you mean by that?
When the YIMBYs arose, I was like, awesome, this makes sense, right? Like, you know, opponents of development or people who are cautious about development, they have their place, they deserve their voices, that's all fine. But obviously, there always needs to be a counter voice, and people who have different interests always need the right and the ability to speak their mind. So I was like, great, we're going to bring some balance to the conversation, and hopefully we'll compromise, and the state henceforth will, you know, meet somewhere in the middle, and then that'll be great. And that's the rational me speaking. Especially, I'd say, in the past year, I think we've seen a really interesting backlash whereby rather than the YIMBYs and the proverbial NIMBYs balancing each other out, the anti-development interests have, I would say, gotten more powerful in some ways, used their existing power to magnify their voices in certain ways, because now they have an opposition. So yes, the opposition's good, but the opposition in some ways has made the establishment even stronger. And as you sort of alluded, kind of put them on their heels for a moment and almost envisioning, oh my gosh, we're under attack, you know, as much as the majority can possibly be under attack. So now I think there's a sense of grievance and a sense of somewhat a sense of, I'd say, sort of a snide attitude. Oh, who are these young people who think they know what land use is? So we're seeing some really, I'd say, almost vitriolic responses in some cases. Not so vitriolic would be like the rise of Livable California, you know, which is a group that I don't even know if it existed a few years ago, but it certainly exists now and is a very loud voice that that sends out messages and studies and so forth. And whenever they send out a message, you can hear it repeated all over the place. You know, I feel like homeowners associations often are listening in on their conferences, which they probably are, and taking those talking points. And again, that's an organization that didn't exist or wasn't, you know, prominent many years ago. I think that there, I've seen even on, you know, I make the mistake of going on Nextdoor, you know, and looking at the homeowner discussions and seeing the vitriol around discussions of housing and homelessness and really perceiving these, you know, mostly homeowners feeling like they're under attack. And one really interesting example of this is now this new recall movement. Here in LA, Nithya Raman, whom I interviewed a few months ago, is a new council member, and she was elected on a quasi-YIMBY platform. And, you know, she's brand new. She's an urban planner by trade, which is really interesting. And she's a city council person. 6 months later, she's already facing a recall effort because the people who didn't vote for her in the first place are now just aghast that she's actually trying to fulfill the campaign promises about more housing that she ran on and presumably her supporters voted for. But I'd say the recall effort to recall her, and there's also a recall effort in West LA, mainly over homelessness more than housing, is an example of the sort of traditional anti-development forces really flexing their muscles and really what I would say, you know, bringing out the big guns, as it were, to maintain their political power. So in some ways, I feel like we've escalated the land use discussion in a lot of places rather than balanced it. And we'll see how it turns out.
You know, interesting related thought here in San Diego. So we have Council President Jen Campbell, San Diego City Council President. I would not say that she ran as a YIMBY. I think when she was elected, I don't think anybody would have described her that way. Even her early time in office, I don't think anybody would have particularly seen her as a YIMBY. But then in office, she got to work. And one of the things she did was she proposed a ballot measure that rescinded the coastal height limit for the Midway community, which is where the sports arena is. And it passed overwhelmingly. And that, along with a couple other things that she had done, encouraged this sort of neighborhood faction to pursue a recall. Now, I think they may have inadvertently revealed that they don't actually possess the power that they thought they did. And I think because their recall initiative failed, they were mm-hmm. unable to collect enough signatures to put it on the ballot. And so I actually think it at least here, it offers yet another data point around the idea that some of these things that had been perceived as third rail issues in San Diego politics may actually not be that controversial, or at least maybe are not as controversial as they had been seen as. I mean, the coastal height limit was, I wrote a story in 2013 about the coastal height limit and its, you know, sort of sacrosanct place in city politics. And on his own volition, then city councilman Kevin Faulkner, just because somebody had written about it, put out a statement saying, just to be clear, we're not touching the coastal height limit. Absolutely no, there's no circumstance in which we'll touch the coastal height limit. And then he himself as mayor supported this initiative to raise the coastal height limit in the Midway area. So potentially, I think the politics of opposition for neighborhood groups risk revealing that their perceived power may be greater than their actual power. And at least in San Diego, I think that's what we've seen.
No, and that may be true. You're right. These recall efforts might be a last gasp more mm-hmm. than a recovery of power. And yeah, you're right. You know, your council member in San Diego prevailed. We'll yet see. And you're right. I think Rahman and my council member Bonin probably will prevail. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be interesting to see where it goes from there. So yeah, I think, you know, your mention of height limits in San Diego is really interesting. And the idea that homeowners might be opposed to height limits, which I think is one of the great ironies of the land use discussion and of the naivete, I'll call it, around land use in California. Because, you know, most progressive planners will tell you, and it's not that hard an argument, that if you make certain places more dense, higher, you know, more people, more mixed use and so forth, that does a lot of good things. And one of the good things it does is it relieves the pressure from the single family neighborhoods. If I can take an apartment in the Midway, then I'm less inclined to like buy a house or God forbid to want a duplex, a house, you know, someplace in the more suburban areas. So when homeowners oppose urban density, I think it's really interesting that they're actually opposing their own interests and opposing many people's interests. But yeah, there's this idea that like density is like this scary thing. And it's like, no, it doesn't have to be scary. And actually, like, it might actually, even though it's not the lifestyle that you want, you know, you homeowner might not want to live in an apartment in the Midway. It doesn't mean that someone else doesn't, maybe Andy, maybe me. And it doesn't mean that that apartment doesn't actually have a collateral benefit for the whole city, potentially.
Yeah. Rather than seeing it as a comprehensive planning effort, they see it instead as a slippery slope. You mentioned when we were talking offline that sort of your perception covering the whole state is that San Diego is a bit ahead of the conversation and maybe is being a bit more progressive than, say, LA or San Francisco. I'd be interested in hearing you talk a little bit more about that and maybe if you have any theories as to why the politics or the policy conversation here might be a little bit further along.
Sure. That's a tough question because I'm in a room full of San Diego experts. But yeah. It's sort of fun to throw my perception out there and, you know, and for you all as the audience to decide, you know, if my perception is more flattering than it deserves to be or whatnot. So, you know, if we look at the snapshot of the past year, it's interesting to look at the different cities in the state. And if we look at San Francisco, for instance, politically progressive in so many ways, but as you may or may not know, because it's 500 miles away from you, on land use, San Francisco has had a lot of tension and arguably is not very progressive. There are a lot of anti-development forces in San Francisco, you know, where the housing crisis is the most acute because the rents are the highest and so on and so forth. We've got one city that I think is in sort of stalemate in a lot of ways. Then we have LA, which I think is in stalemate in its own different way, which is if people are sort of over-involved in San Francisco, I think they've always been under-involved in LA. You know, as much as the YIMBY movement has grown up, as much as people care about land use in LA, LA is a city, and I'll get to this, is this the culture of LA, where people are famous for doing their own thing. People are famous for worrying about what film deal they're going to make. They're also famous for worrying about where the next meal is going to come from. You know, we're such a stratified, segregated city, which is a shame. And I think the labor of living in LA and the fact that like our cultural hallmark is the freeway that sort of pits all of us against each other, right? It's hard to be communal when your main interaction is wishing the person in front of you, you know, on the freeway wasn't actually there. So we don't have a lot of collaboration in LA, and that lets sort of the city government kind of like fly under the radar and often not get much done. What I've noticed in San Diego, though, which is so interesting because it's, you know, again, famous for being much more suburban than LA and certainly more than San Francisco, is that you've adopted some progressive notions. And I think the most obvious one off the top of my head, are a lot of the parking reforms that you've instituted, you know, which is, has been a holy grail for planners, you know, ever since the early 2000s when Don Shoup's book came out. And you're actually doing it. You're doing, and so is Sacramento for that matter. Sacramento's a really interesting city. I think you've grabbed onto that issue more readily. I think some of the densification you're doing around transit, and you've had, I think you embraced the trolley long, you know, before LA embraced its light rail system. You know, I think there's some other pro-density, pro-mixed use policies that I've seen, you know, in dribs and drabs, you know, come out of San Diego that I wouldn't have expected initially out of, you know, again, a more politically conservative. And I think that's the interesting part, is that politically San Diego is still more conservative on sort of the big, you know, left-right issues. And yet there are a lot of progressive land use pieces, which may be a reflection of sort of the business pragmatism of San Diego, whereas LA has become just, you know, doing business in LA is very, very hard, as most of the developers will tell you. So that's my hot take on San Diego.
Yeah, I do wonder if there's a partisanship explanation for it, because people might have heard me tell this story before. When the YIMBY Democrats of San Diego County, that's the local YIMBY group here, had its opening party, it was when the California Democratic Party was having its convention in downtown San Diego. And I went there to cover it, and they had some high-profile elected Democrats speaking to the crowd. And I was standing next to an affordable housing developer from San Francisco who was in town for the convention. So he went to this party. And Scott Peters, Congressman Scott Peters, who's a Democrat and used to be on the city council, was there. And when he was giving his speech, he said, you know, I think it's so great that this club constituted itself in the Democratic Party specifically, outside of the party. And I'm hearing that as somebody in San Diego who is accustomed to the fact that at that time we had three Republicans on the city council. The Republicans controlled the county board of supervisors, and the affordable housing developer from San Francisco was standing next to me, and he looked at me and said, "You guys have Republicans here?" And I wonder if there's something about the fact that this hadn't been yet a one-party city that gave space in a different way for this, that where in San Francisco, it's sort of it's a fight among who can be most progressive. Mm-hmm. And so you see a lot of like far left NIMBYism basically. And so I don't really know if that's a good explanation, but it stuck out to me at the time.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, I mean, I think the politics of land use and how it matches up and doesn't with national left-right issues is interesting and often paradoxical. And I think you're right. The idea that San Diego has more space for these discussions, and like you said, in San Francisco, the left is sort of cannibalizing itself and can't agree. And we see it in LA also. I wrote a bit about. I have some articles here about, you know, the radical left, which I think often when it comes to land use, you know, runs completely counter to what its values are. And the people it most wants to help, which are, you know, underprivileged, you know, historically marginalized peoples who deserve the help and who deserve roofs over their heads. Often there's so much demonization of developers, which is the title of one of my essays, that people can't see clear to be like, oh, well, a developer deserves to make their, you know, 7% profit IRR. And we can put roofs over people's heads. So I think, yeah, and that's where the politics gets so screwy, often to the point of stalemate. And I think in San Diego, it's broken through a little bit.
Thanks for listening to this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. We'll be back on Friday, as usual, with our weekly roundup of local news. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can learn more about the San Diego Tijuana Urban Land Institute at sandiego-tijuana.uli.org. Pick up a copy of Josh's book, The Urban Mystique, Notes on California, Los Angeles, and Beyond. It's a great way to get to know everything that's happened in land development in California over the last 10 years. And of course, you can keep up with any land use stories here in San Diego here at Voice of San Diego with the Morning Report newsletter. Get that at vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Andrew Keats, assistant editor at Voice of San Diego. This show is produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening. Talk soon.